I'm Duncan McLeod, and this is the Tech Central Show, which is brought to you today by MTN Business. Visit mtnbusiness.co.za to learn about their products and solutions. And we thank them for partnering with Tech Central to bring you these great interviews. And we have a great guest in the studio today. Kudusele Piche is a well-known businessman and investor in the ICT sector in South Africa, particularly on the infrastructure side of things. He's founder and CEO of investment vehicle NewGX Capital, and he was an early backer in Dark Fiber Africa. And NewGX has just announced a new clean tech fund with RMB Ventures, and we'll talk about that shortly. Kudu, it's great to see you. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks for hosting me, Duncan.
That's my pleasure. It's great to finally meet you at last. We've spoken many times on the phone. It's
yes,
nice, nice to meet you in person. I want to start chatting about your dad, if you don't mind, as a sort of an opener. Sure. H.M. Piche, as he was known, also a very well-known individual. He was, correct me if I'm wrong, elected mayor of Mamelodi back in 1969.
Yes.
But he was also a businessman, right?
Agreed, yes. He was the first mayor of Mamelodi, but he had this talent of spotting opportunities and started a small business whilst were what was called a kitchen boy in those days and built himself enough savings to start showing movies at community halls.
Okay.
And he ended up building a cinema and in Mamelodi as well, and supported the community. But unfortunately, in the 80s, some politicians, which they admitted in the Judge Krigler Commission, went after all these businesses and destroyed them. So we were left with nothing from the 80s.
Yeah. Why?
He was, whilst the mayor, a very strict and honorable man, and he lived for the communities. And what ended up happening, they ended up coming up with rates arrears, which he tried to get into a payment plan with them, even though they couldn't prove that he owed the money. And regardless of the payment plan, they still went after him. And at the commission, from what I understand, one of the individuals admitted that they wanted him either dead or they destroyed his businesses. So fortunately for us, I always say to my family, they went after the businesses.
So was this the white apartheid government that went after him?
It was the Mamelodi Council. I forgot in those days what they were called. And the individuals are named in the commission's outcome. Actually, Judge Krigler said to the municipality, which is now the Tshwane municipality, apologize and compensate the family for what has happened to them. We're still trying to get that out of them. But fortunately, I learned some skills from him, which have led the family back to business.
Okay, good to hear, good to hear. So, Kudu, actually, while I was researching for this interview, I came across an interesting article that said when your dad passed away in 1997, you kept a newspaper clipping about that, and you wrote across the newsprint, "I will make you proud." Do you still have that newspaper clipping?
I do, yes, indeed. So we're starting to make digital copies of his articles and putting them up at our head office in Illovo, and that that drives who I am.
Still, you know, today. So
even today. Mm-hmm. And he was someone that I followed around at, I think, age 10. I used to look after some of his businesses. And probably at age 11, he would take time out if I'm on holiday. So he played a big role of who I am as a man and a businessman. And this is someone who didn't go to school. So... And taught me a lot of what I know about accounting. Ended up being the top accounting student at school just from being taught how to count on a piece of paper. You know, and that newspaper article still drives a lot of what we do today. So my wife looks after the foundation. We've got 8,000 scholars under management. We are now starting to ramp up our skills development programs, about 500 youth that we find job training and job opportunities for.
And he was, of course, the mayor of Mamelodi, so he had a political side to him as well. You weren't interested in following him into the politics?
With what happened to him, it scares me. I think I always say to people, we probably have in our history three public sector related projects, and I always say all three ended up in court. And,
really?
And tell young people, if you want to disrupt, don't let government be the anchor of your disruption. Mm-hmm. Come up with what private sector sees as value adding, and then ramp up from there. Mm-hmm. And that's why you see how New GX is structured today. Mm-hmm. We are very much focused a lot on how we disrupt in the public sector space.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's talk about New GX Capital then. When was it founded, and why did you found it originally?
I am a CA by profession, work for JP Morgan in South Africa and the UK. I was fortunate, even as an analyst, worked on the Telkom listing, so I got an insight into the telecommunication sector. When I went to the UK, I also worked for the telecommunication team and the oil and gas team. So coming back in 2004, I thanked JP Morgan for the opportunity, and I said, that's where our road end, but I really appreciate what you've done for me as an individual, because it was, if I remember, my second international trip ever. First one was Thailand, and London was the next one. And really looked at the BE space, what is called the BE space, I guess, and I saw a gap for a value-adding BE player that can take opportunities from nothing to something, mm-hmm. or can run large-sized businesses. And because I could invest and operate, I was able to do due diligence, interpret where the businesses should be positioned. I mean, there's an environmental risk management consulting business that we acquired in, I think, 2005. Mm-hmm. We're still involved with them. So we've seen them from, call it, 5 million turnover to 34 million turnover. It's called Shangoni Management Services. It plays a critical role in us understanding compliances for our clean tech fund, because mm-hmm. they deal with water use application licenses. They deal with health and safety. And we've built on from there. And that was what drove me. And APSA Capital back then, led by Andre Pieterse, took note of what I was doing. And they asked me to make an application. I think by then they'd only backed Mvela Pande. Mm-hmm. And I put in a funds of funds application and started drafting the strategy for the fund, which led them to say, please go and look at a small investment holding company. Back then it was called CIE Telecoms, mm-hmm. Which is today CIVH. And then I met with the founder, Nick Fenter, and I found that what I was planning to do actually dovetailed well with CIVH.
Okay, fascinating. Yeah. You mentioned you were involved in the telecom listing at JP Morgan.
Yeah.
That must have been a really interesting project to be involved in at the time. Is that where your interest in telecommunications first started to emerge?
Yes, indeed. It's in my path, you're now starting to understand fixed and wireless because of the various assets in it. And I was supporting the Department of Public Enterprise. I think it was the Project Management Office. And it gave me great insight on the possibilities of the sector. But in the UK, then I used to support my bosses for proposals from MMO2 for other large MNOs and also OEMs. So you started now doing research into OEMs, and that gave me that insight into mm-hmm. the sector, which I then followed mm-hmm. through with a career, I guess, as an investor. Mm-hmm.
Now, CIVH, I actually don't know the history of that company. Yes. I know about the formation of DFA and later Vumatel, yes. and the acquisition of those assets. Yes. When you invested, what was CIVH?
So back then, as CIE Telecoms, mm-hmm. it was backing owner-led businesses.
Okay.
So you had the likes of, We had the likes of Dotcom, we had the likes of a manufacturing business in Boxburg. Mm-hmm. We had MCT, which used to monitor Telkom's fixed line network. And mm-hmm. that's where the capability started coming from for the early adoption of DFA.
Okay.
And ClearLine, the search protection business, was also under that fold. But it was a bunch of really great entrepreneurs. Richard Kame, who's well known to
Richard,
to
yes.
Mm-hmm. Nick Venter, Gustav Smith, and the late Celia Stein. Together with our partner CIH, and we all used to meet 3 times a week and allocate responsibilities across these various assets until a point where a group of engineers came to us talking about the change in the fiber landscape and how the sector through deregulation will open up.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed to bring these trucks from Marea Group, and they needed some capital, and we supported them.
Okay.
And from that, we then asked them what's something else we can do with these machines. Said, well, you could set up the client and we become the engineering house. And we modeled that. One of the founders, Gustav Smith, who became the CEO for some time.
I remember Gustav.
Yes, yeah. Was seconded to the asset, with all of us playing a role in attracting the likes of Venfern, making sure we get our ICASA license.
And so Venfern, that's where the Remgro connection comes in.
Yes. Okay. So then Richard Kame, who had a history with Venfern, I flew down with him to Cape Town, and we convinced them to back us in those early days. And I think that's what brought some confidence in this would be a business that can withstand the 5 or 10 year leases that we required for the business model to work. So So a really, really heartwarming experience when you remember that the first Mtunzini link for undersea to terrestrial was done by a private business. And it was the first time that a private business other than Telkom has managed to do that. So
interesting. Yeah, I've been down to that landing station in Frenzini, actually. Yeah. It's very nondescript, which I think is deliberate.
Yeah.
I want you to know what's inside that building. But so CIBH has obviously morphed into something much bigger today. It owns Vumatel, which is the biggest fiber to the home operator in South Africa, Dark Fiber Africa, which I think is the Telkom, maybe bigger on dark fiber.
Yeah.
This is a big business today, and we know that Vodacom is in the process of potentially buying a 30% stake in Maziv, which is a new company. So it's under CIVH.
Yeah.
And we know this process has been stuck at the competition authorities for a period of over 3 years, I think it is now. What is your take? I mean, lots of views have been expressed on the competition process and what's happened. A lot of criticism for the competition authorities over the time it's taken for this deal to occur. But what's your take on what's happened?
So from my family office perspective and not a CIVH perspective as an investor, I think disappointed in the fact that this is probably one of the unique businesses where two black families were founding members of what everyone sees today.
Mm-hmm.
And that in all the processes where you talk about public interest, you normally have to address BEE, this business was built amongst others by two black families that were involved in the business. And two, it's an open access type of network on the DFA side,
mm-hmm.
which means we've unlocked a lot of potential for smaller ISPs to participate in the market. And what really is that drive to bridge the digital divide between the suburbs and the township is what we've also managed to get our heads around.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the first prepaid fiber network that you can get anywhere, I can say Africa, but potentially in the world. And we had to figure out that model and also figure out how you distribute. So everybody knows how to distribute mobile products and other technologies. But this you had to build from scratch and also not forget about the lower LSM like Alex, which mm-hmm. when we acquired Vuma, we gave an indication that we're working on optimizing that model. So for me, that market, for anybody to predetermine what would be technology overlaps in a market where you're creating a new product, for me is hard to recognize. And also not appreciating the control structure of CIVH. So between Remgro and ourselves, we jointly controlled CIVH at the top, and Vodacom would be getting some rights at Massive. So it would mean that two controlling investors would want to lose value by losing the essence of what Massive was set up for the benefit of Vodacom, which is, I can tell you, for as long as we shareholders, is highly unlikely to happen, because it's been 20 years of ramping up the network. We as a family were fortunate to attract institutional investors who backed us in a fund to be able to keep up, as you can imagine, 500 to 600 rand a meter to roll out this infrastructure. Mm-hmm. By now, you know, I always joke with my partners that my uncle doesn't own a bank. So I needed to find backers to keep up, and also to see the benefits of it. I mean, for in this environment where unemployment is over 30% and there's an entity promising billions in capital to be deployed and promising about circa 10,000 jobs to be created, I don't think there's that type of deal should be left wanting for 3 years. And naturally, if you see Europe, South America, consolidation happens, you know. So, and I guess here the trick was, would it happen with FNOs consolidating, or would it happen with MNOs and FNOs consolidating? And it happens that in South Africa, it's taken a FNO and MNO consolidation, but we also bring these assets of Vodacom back into an open access network, meaning that others who didn't have access to it will get access to it. And from all the interference from, I mean, it's a strategic minority, yes, with rights, but against a majority shareholder who has two controlling shareholders. So for myself, I think, and for our family, disappointed to see that such a landmark transaction has been ongoing for over 3 years. And I can imagine it's impacted probably how foreign investment view South Africa from a regulation point of view. I think regulation certainty, I think that's why the energy sector is booming. Regulation certainty is key.
Mm-hmm.
And for me,
because no one can really make a decision if a regulator is going to take 3 years to decide on it, right?
You, when you look at the value of assets as a foreign investor, what do you discount for when there's uncertainty?
Mm.
You know, because and then as a local who's worked close to 20 years building value, how's that value destroyed in the process? And I remember saying to someone that the losers here are the two black families that have been involved for 20 years, and potentially the lower LSM markets, where I think expansion would have happened faster. But but I guess it's one of those things that we have to deal with as investors, and one of those things that has hopefully at the end of it the country wins with a process that's concluded.
It's now going, of course, to the Competition Appeal Court. Are you confident that that this will actually get over the line at the end of the day?
We were confident with the tribunal. Okay. So our confidence level, I think we're doing this because it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the right thing, not just for us, for the sector. So you can imagine if consolidation doesn't happen, what happens to other players? What happens to OpenServe? What happens to... So I think it has a direct impact on a sector that whose natural next step is consolidation.
Okay. UGX Capital, how would you describe the business today? Is it a private equity player, an investment holding company?
We've actually evolving from a family office arrangement to an asset manager. So we moving various assets of ours as our contribution towards building a fund platform. So we have this clean tech one anchored by RMB, but we will soon be announcing, hopefully still this year, a digital tech AI. And we will also, in time, hopefully next year, announce a private equity brand and a VC brand. So we would be taking 20 years lessons and putting it into four platforms to align and make sure that we focus on what is core to the platforms versus what Kudu thinks he can add value to. You know, so it's really razor focused on opportunities and also building new GX for a legacy run where in call it 10 years time, if I want to focus on international markets, that the team in South Africa can continue building the legacy. And hopefully one day my kids see this brand that their father went through a period building and making a difference in the country and the continent.
Good objectives. Yeah. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there. Apologies. Tadek, if you just make a note. Yes. Do you want an audio marker? Are you okay? You're good. Okay. So apart from CIVH, what are some of the investee businesses in UGX Capital today? I know you're an investor or you control Dotcom, the fiber...
Distribution business. Yeah. Yes. The asset, unfortunately, has gone through, as the sector shrinks, has gone through tough times where we're remodeling the business. But we've got a good business in East Africa, which we want to grow and hopefully leave the South African business as a manufacturing of fiber cables. And so we're busy consolidating that into one business unit. And then the East Africa business as a managed service business, which has been operating for over 6 years. Mm. So there's lots of lessons learned in evolution and change of business environments. And then we've got other pockets of from a supply chain tech business, enhanced supply chain. We backed the team when they were still doing about 20-odd million turnover a year. And we've grown it into a tech business that does in excess of 200 million. So a really like championing the likes of Spar2U. They recently won a mandate with the likes of Tiger Brands and Twin Savers. So a tier 1 to 3 type of application that we hope to take abroad. And we also own a small stake in Tracker, the vehicle tracking business. Yeah. And we own a stake in Skynet, which is an interesting project we pursued with RMB, where we're consolidating a courier network across Hong Kong, UK, Germany, South Africa, Mozambique, and Namibia. And we also backed a medical entrepreneur, a radiologist, who developed a platform called Envisionate AI.
I've heard of that.
Yes, we backed them to get their FDA approval and compliance. And now the business has achieved quite a key milestones. It's Bayer, the OEM, has put them on their marketplace. Blackford has put them on their marketplace. Mayo Clinic is engaging them and other large med tech platforms that we can tap into. So we'll go on a capital raise for them this year. And we think that business has potential to be acquired by one of the big OEMs. And that sits in our RMB JV, which is called New GX Ventures. Mm-hmm. And then we've also tapped into international markets. So followed some of our business partners in as a passive investor in a US fiber platform and other platforms that give us sort of Euro exposure, but as like a passive player just to balance the rand and the hard currency portfolio in our digital infrastructure. And 6 years ago, were the co-founder and first investors of this digital utility called Fungi Energy. And it's really now competing with large players in the utility management space. That has become our brain to invest into solar and other products.
Okay.
And let me just see which business we've... Because we try and chase that whole smart city applications, and we're currently piloting one for townships and secondary cities that hopefully we'll be able to announce in 3 months' time.
You have your fingers in a lot of pies, and there's more, because we're going to talk about current developers now. Yes. And we ran an article here on Tech Central a few weeks ago about new GX Capital and RMB Ventures, part of First Rand Group. The two businesses have jointly created a new investment vehicle called Energize. Is that how you pronounce it? Yep. Energize.
Spelled Energize.
A-I-R-N-E-G-I-Z-E Capital.
Yes.
And this new fund has already raised 2.5 billion rand in initial commitments, with another 1.5 billion or so targeted for the months ahead before the initial fund close.
Yes.
Tell us about this fund. What's the thinking behind it, and where are you going to invest all this money?
Sure. I think first you have to believe that disruption will come from decentralized utility infrastructure. So going from lumpy projects like Kusile mm-hmm. to on-site, close to the end user, whether it's water, gas, or energy, I think the same will apply, but also wrapped with some smart technology. So when you believe in that world, then it says industries we're going to talk about don't exist today, or they're still small and haven't scaled and therefore required large pool of capital. And how do you also make investors comfortable to unlock the true potential of providing clean energy or water to the townships? Mm-hmm. So instead of it lagging like fiber, you sort of create a channel for investors to put in money there. And then the rest of the continent. So then the journey started 6 years ago with Fungi, and Fungi has grown into a really niche player in its market, mm-hmm. and very proud of what it's done. And followed by SPS. SPS was known as Metal Solar. It was owned by Metal. And it was on our journey.
The private equity firm Metal.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. So it was on our journey of building our own C&I portfolio. So I traveled to the US to learn about various panel OEMs, various technologies. Mm-hmm. And when I came back, I was the salesperson on the road. Mm-hmm. And I called one of the family office saying, "You've got a lot of real estate. Can I put solar on your roofs?" They said, "Look, we've got an asset that's done that. Do you want to acquire it?" And we ended up acquiring it. And in the process, inheriting a partner in Gridworks, which is wholly owned by BII, the UK DFI, and also our business partner, the co-founder, Francois, who's still involved in the business. And we've really taken it from a subscale CNI business to over 100 megawatts with a pipeline of over 600. So it was the right time to place it in a platform that has sufficient capital mm-hmm. to carry it forward. And we now in South Africa, Namibia, Kenya, we're going into Zambia, we're in Seychelles, potentially Mauritius, Uganda and Tanzania. So it's really a Pan-Africa player that we want to back together with Gridworks to scale it up and become one of the biggest CNI businesses in the continent.
Focused on providing infrastructure to business or to consumers as well?
Business. So this business. One is a specialist solar and storage, mm-hmm. doesn't touch wind or any other technology. We're busy looking through the market to see if we can back an experienced development team in the wind technology side. And then also we've separated gas from the definition of energy, because gas can come in form of dirty clean gas. So we always refer to our platform as energy, water, and gas. And we're now building our gas strategy, which can go from import storage mm. to right to trading to LPG versus other forms and to hydrogen. So we're busy formulating that strategy. And then the water strategy, also talking to one or two players who we think have got the model right. And we want to back them in the CNI mining space, which still has a lot of room for investment.
We know that not just in the South African context, globally, telecommunications historically was seen as a, a, a service that was provided by the state. Yeah. And you had these state-owned monopolies like Telkom in South Africa that provided, they were given an exclusivity to provide these services to consumer on the assumption that this is not something that the private sector could provide. That whole model was upended over the last 20 years, yeah. including in South Africa, by the likes of CIVH, yeah. particularly by the likes of CIVH, sure. which showed that actually the state doesn't have to be running this. In fact, it's more efficient and better for the consumer if there's competition yeah. Between service providers, between infrastructure providers, and the price of bandwidth in South Africa as a result has been driven down considerably. Agreed. Does the same opportunity exist in Agreed. Electricity and water as well?
Agreed. So what I look at is the regulator under pressure. Incumbent can't provide at the right price and provide security. And if you look at that definition of what drives us, then energy is already the disruption is happening. Mm-hmm. Water, I think the regulator just needs to improve and fast track applications for water use licenses and other compliance notices that are required because it's taking too long. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's an estate in Balito. I think it took them all of 6 years to get the application with its own community. That can't be. It should be faster and encourage people to invest. But I think with what we've learned in fiber, also encourage people to invest in the township for the same application so that people in the townships are not left behind. Mm. And again, the true belief that the next utilities are decentralized, then you're on the money on the fact that energy and water will receive the same disruption. Mm. Water, I think, by its nature, requires a lot of thinking because there's only so much of you can drill in a suburb. So, and the water infrastructure is structured in such a way that you can't recreate sort of reservoirs to push into suburbs. Mm-hmm. But I'm certain that with time, you might even see people getting trading license for water where there's excess capacity in one region and you're given the rights to transport and flush into reservoir elsewhere. And that's what you have to believe to set up a clean tech platform like we've set up, mm-hmm. because we believe not only just South Africa, but the continent requires such investments to grow.
In telecommunications, it was the establishment of internet exchanges like the one at Teraco that really helped underpin the growth in the fiber market. Yeah. And are there similar things in electricity and water that sure. are prerequisites to the effective privatization of these services to make them function properly, like electricity trading markets, for example, or yeah. the equivalent in water?
Yeah, I think the electricity trading market is a start, but it's a lot focused on commercial and industrial, and a lot of it, with the exception of Cape Town. Cape Town has gone out saying it will unlock its grid for trading. Mm-hmm. And we're also going to approach them on a concept in one of the townships to see if it does work. And if that works, then you can imagine if you're able to trade solar and storage power in and out of the grid in the township context. That also de-risks from an investor point of view because you can model around it and you can model around the risk. And also I think there's if you think about your house and how you build by the likes of City Power, I am certain if an agency was created that reconciled on behalf of each home and automated reconciles back to City Power, can imagine the amount of savings that will come through from that and also what it would do for working capital of the likes of City Power. So I think this market still has room to unlock further deployment of solar, and it's great to see that the likes of Go Solar and others have taken opportunity, but I think it's a phase. There's still lots to be done. If you think of South Africa with in excess of 16 million homes, everyone's busy chasing the two, but there's a balance that is still viable, and there's a balance of businesses that are still viable. So I think great potential. Yeah.
The government always pushed back against liberalization in the telecommunications sector on the basis that businesses would cherry pick the best markets, the leafy suburbs, and go after those and ignore the mass market, the townships, and all the rest of it. We've seen some investment going into townships. And you clearly, it's a passion of yours to get connectivity into every home in South Africa. We're not there yet, but I think the telecommunications industry is showing that it might be possible. But I think there's still a lot of reluctance in government about saying, well, private sector, go for it. Solve the problem. There's a feeling the government has to be involved in some way. What do you tell politicians who tell you that, sorry, the government has to play a big role here?
When I was in India, I asked them, how did you get this whole BPO and tech market to dominate the world? They said, because government stayed out of it and they allowed us to grow. You know, and I think it's the same message for South Africa when it comes to utilities and essential services like connectivity, energy, water, and I think the gas market also will change. It will play a pivotal role in our energy mix in the country, and you're seeing it even in security for the likes of Vumacam coming up with AI security solutions to provide public safety. You know, so I think government's role in my mind is to make sure there's clear regulation and security of asset is clearly understood, and also not using things like way leaves in the telecom sector to slow down people or issue multiple way leaves for the same area without realizing that the same contractors are going to dig the same road. And if you just look at the township environment, 900 billion GDP market, 60% of it formal. So we're all chasing a 500 billion rand market, and we all first think of risk versus the opportunity. And I always say to my team, why are shopping centers there? Why are beverage distributors there? There's a market. We just need to design a product that particular market appreciates and provides value to, and I think adoption will happen. You know, and one of the success townships for Bumatel has been Mitchell's Plain. It's been a phenomenal success, and because once the community understood the power of connectivity, adoption happened. And it's you've seen people run their businesses from home.
I believe take up there has been huge.
It's been incredible. And you can see, I mean, call centers are now being built in Mitchell's Plain. It can change how people perceive townships and also save people money from traveling to town. You're now working and buying in the township environment. And I think one of the classical example is in Alex when we did a site visit, and a lady who, there's one entrepreneur who owns the apartments and she charges an amount that I think even people in some of the suburbs would be proud of charging for for a room, and she added connectivity to it. Tenants didn't complain, and I asked one of the tenants, why does this work for you? He says, I'd rather pay my landlord 100 odd a month to save 2,000 that I used to spend on traveling. Now I'm selling my products from my one bedroom because it goes from there to my consumer through a distribution agent. So that type of impact I don't think is documented as yet. And if you look at e-commerce, I mean, one of our investments in Hans is involved in Spar2U. So you can imagine the impact of having connectivity in each home on adoption of online shopping and what job creation for our youth, the ability of our youth to design and manufacture products at a township level to sell to the suburbs or to sell internationally is there. So I think an exciting path if government plays a supportive role rather than a controlling role
or an obstructive role in the case of the regulators, as we talked about earlier. You're obviously very passionate about uplifting communities, and poorer communities in South Africa by definition are mostly black. How important is it that this new fund is black managed and controlled? And allied to that, there's been a lot of debate lately about the role of BEE in South Africa in 2025, with some people suggesting maybe it's even run its course. What's your take on the role of BEE today?
I think being a child of a township trader who couldn't get facilities at banks because they were black and living in townships, I think you need to appreciate that first before you say BEE has played its role. And secondly, it's for me, it's more the execution of what is really a transformative legislation that has failed us. I think there's smarter and harder working kudus out there who haven't been able to be accessed because it hasn't been implemented correctly. So if you look at the different pillars of BEE, from equity to SMME development, I mean, if those are applied for the benefit of the country and not just as a ticking exercise, I think the impact on it can be quite material. You know, everybody always focuses on the public sector and tenders and all, but nobody actually looks at the private sector and say, what could you have done differently instead of getting the politically connected partner? You got the young partners that are going to roll up their sleeves and make a difference instead of moving the SMME development money into a passive fund to earn an interest. Why didn't you hire a team to create businesses and expand them? I think if you look into that, there's a role for the legislation to play if it's executed correctly.
So how would you like to see the BEE framework adjusted in South Africa going forward? What should we be doing differently? What should the government be doing differently? What should the regulations say that's different to the way it's done today?
Yes. I think like township, if you think of this 500 billion formal, I mean, who is funding those businesses that are part of that 500 billion GDP? You know, could there be others that could scale if they had access to capital? Are there entrepreneurs who've been knocking on doors and not getting access to capital? Is there a way government can do a proper economic analysis of each township to understand the opportunity set? I'll give you an example. Soshanguve, we come from Soshanguve. My parents had a home. I converted it into a 30-bed student accommodation just to see whether what I'm thinking in my head is possible. I think under a kilometer from the gate of TUT.
Okay.
The misery of registration on that process. I thought, if I'm struggling like this, what's happening to the homes that are across the road from the university? We're still, and I could have this number wrong, but close to 2,000 students driving into Soshanguve from town to come to the same. So now if I'm government and I want to lock proper wealth for these families that are across the road, a standard design, a fund, and you implement that fund, you have standard contracting, you don't have any human interference on the other side on the applications, you change lives. You completely change lives. And also just making sure our education system, so one of the key focus for us in our foundation is early childhood development. I mean, my wife and I happened to go to the same school, in primary school in Soshanguve. And when we walked there and you realize some of the stats that you've been given, I think township kids are on a mountain of note to climb to get to be here at an interview like I am at. It's you're finding a lack of understanding of how to actually impart knowledge to the kids, lack of access to technology, lack of infrastructure, and you can go on. So we've now partnered with a farming community learning platform that then consults for us and places interventions around maths, English, and you can see the difference. But if that is coordinated in a way in what we refer to as BEE in those pillars, because in those pillars, they're good things. There's education, there's SMME development, there's CSI. So if those are applied properly, the impact to this country would be notable. But at the moment, we're all focusing, and I'm not saying we shouldn't, we're all focusing on what's gone wrong with the tenders, but we should also be focusing what could private sector do differently to make sure these funds reach the townships and black youth who in the 30% plus unemployment form a big part of that.
Just lastly, the new Energize Capital Fund. Yes. Based on what you've told me in this discussion, you're not only measuring its impact on ROI.
Yeah.
How will you determine the success of this particular fund?
Sure. I think, one, we need to close the $4 billion capital raise, and we're not too far from that. I think we've got three investors line of sight, and we're hoping in 3 months we will get pretty close to that or beat the $4 billion mark. Two is investing in assets that are aligned with what we believe as impact. So when we buy into a business, the HMPJ Foundation, we present it as the channel towards impact in townships for black youth and skills development. And there'll be transactions where people push back and we'll say, look, then you're not aligned because this is not for me. This is as a channel to make sure that CSI money gets to the townships and create impact. And also supply chain. I remember when we acquired Vumatel, I think it was a level 6 or so BE. Now, the massive group is close to level, I think it's level 1 BE rated. So it means that every time there's a board meeting, there's rigor around discussion around how we hire the talent, how we spot black talent. We're not just ticking a box here.
Right.
We must spot real talent and build it around the business plan versus saying, in with this and out with that. That's not how you build a business. You build it around a business plan and also enterprise development, making sure. I mean, there have been instances where a young installer in Attridgeville receives a 20 million rand order, you know, and sometimes you get good ones who take advantage of it, and sometimes somebody disappoints you and really doesn't complete the work, you know. But if we just keep trying, I mean, we've seen some really brilliant future leaders who've come through an email of, my name is so, I don't have a job, can you please help? And there's an actuarial scientist who's now one of the future leaders of Enhance. And recently there was an article on a lady by the name of Skiliwe, who my wife had hired as part of a skills development program. And she managed to take her sisters to school, who's just graduated, I think, with an HR TVET diploma. And she used the stipend to actually make sure that she can better the life of her sister. So for us, it's those stories we want to see more and more of. And we need to also apply it in a Pan-African theme, because SPS is not just in SA. So whatever we learn in South Africa, we must also diligently apply in the rest of the continent.
Kudu Piche, it's been great to chat to you and great to finally meet you. Kudu Piche is founder and CEO of New GX Capital. Thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot for hosting me, Duncan.